Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Carol Felsenthal, Khalil Marar, John McGovern, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. Well, in American political history, there are particular moments. There are particular things that candidates say, and many of the things that they say are forgotten. But every once in a while, there are things that are said that perhaps the candidate wishes they would not say, like George Bush saying, "Read my lips, no new taxes." That sort of ended his political career, or at least a second chance at the White House. Then there was, of course, President Bush on the aircraft carrier saying, "Mission accomplished." And unfortunately, too many Americans have died since he uttered those words, or that uttered those words and saw that sign. And now we have the case of a Democrat who has made a promise, and it appears that he has broken the promise. First of all, let's take a listen and watch what the promise made by Barack Obama running for president, and this is what he had to say when asked questions about those who were going to engage with in Obamacare and whether or not they were ever going to be able to, or they whether they were going to be able to keep their doctors and their health care plan. Let's take a look and listen.
And that means that no matter how we reform health care, we will keep this promise to the American people. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor, period. If you like your health care plan, you will be able to keep your health care plan, period. No one will take it away, no matter what. My view is that healthcare reform should be guided by a simple principle: fix what's broken and build on what works. And that's what we intend to do.
Khalil Marar joins us. He is from Governor State University. You're one of our Democrats tonight.
You're a Democrat?
Do we have, is this more than a broken promise? Is it really a signal of a broken presidency?
I think it's a broken system. It's a signal of a broken system. I mean, the truth is, a lot of the health plans that the government has a problem with, if there's any problem at all, is the fact that they don't do the minimal things to cover the Americans that they seek to cover. So there are three ways that you basically don't have a sufficient health insurance policy. First,
let's deal with the politics.
Sure.
Was he telling the truth, John McGovern?
Well, apparently he wasn't. And I think whether the plans aren't up to snuff to what the government wants or not, the point is the president said, if you like what you have, you get to keep it. And I think this is a crisis of both credibility and confidence in this president.
It's not his fault.
How is it not his fault?
Let's go to Carol. Let's get everybody engaged.
This is his plan and his policy. Right.
Carol Felsenthal, a blogger, a writer, a journalist, you're going to look at it objectively and you're going to say what?
I was going to say you left out two very important words when we went over the constant re-loop of that video, and that is, for emphasis, he said period.
Period.
So it made it even more so. There is the issue of grandfathering those plans, and the small, relative to the more than 300 million people in the United States, we're talking about, what is it, about 12 million?
Sure.
5%, however that works out, of people who have these individual plans who were not grandfathered. And the
I want to get Mike Miller in here to answer specifically before we go off into other areas.
Sure.
Does this represent a broken presidency? Is this something that a candidate doesn't get beyond, just like George Bush never got back to talking about important things after that mission accomplished banner went up behind him? prematurely?
I would say no until we learned more, and that was that he was warned that he shouldn't be saying it, and secondly, that the administration right up to the 1st of October said everything was going to be wonderful with this website. It was going to be the greatest website ever. And they knew at the time that that wasn't true.
Well, but I don't know whether the question is, did Obama know? And if
that's his administration,
if they fix it by, it's what, beginning of November now, if they fix it as promised.
We're avoiding the issue. The question, Carol, though, let me finish the question, because you're a journalist and you want people to answer questions. The question here is, did he tell a lie? Did he tell a lie to the American people? Was he uninformed? But he clearly made that point over and over and over again. I mean, he didn't make it five or six times.
Right.
He made it on the campaign trail. He got reelected because people believed that. Right, Khalil?
Yes, that's right. People did believe that. But you have to look at the
impact.
So
what happened? So how does something like that go awry?
Well, we have to look at the definition of a lie. If the president maliciously knew that it wouldn't cover... No, seriously.
Definition, what is it?
He did not know that this would be happening. Again, it's a broken system. The problem is that we have those health insurance plans in the first place.
That's absolutely unacceptable.
Why is it unacceptable?
Well, either he knew or he should have known. This is the core policy for this administration. This is the core issue that he ran on. This is one of the largest changes in our social fabric and in the healthcare industry and insurance industry. And if he didn't know, it's absolutely unacceptable that he didn't know. And if he did know, he clearly was not telling the truth. When he said that clip, and to Carol and Bruce's point, he said that probably 100 times.
Yes. He said it as late as September.
Right, as
2013.
George Bush said, read my lips, no new taxes, I think once or twice during his convention.
Right.
And mission accomplished was only up there for maybe 20 minutes during a speech. But as you say, insofar as something that was said over and over again. By the way, Mitt Romney was on Meet the Press today, and when obviously he was asked about this, he said, quote, he's talking about Obama now, his fundamental dishonesty on the Affordable Care Act has put in peril the whole foundation of his second term. He went on to say, I think it is rotting it away. I mean, strong statements, again, you know, it could be sour grapes. But again, he wants to remind people.
He said everything but use the word lie and liar.
Oh, yeah.
He came up with every euphemism that he could come up with. I was really surprised by how strongly critical
he was.
Mitt Romney. I thought he was extremely effective. But, you know, Barack Obama seems not to know an awful lot, this disengaged president. I think he has a lot of merit. The question, the bugging that we did of the Merkel.
How did he know that we weren't listening to other foreign leaders? I mean, that strains credibility too, doesn't it?
Right. And the website, if anybody comes off looking just like insane in this thing, I think it's Kathleen Sebelius, because she told him that it was going to be ready on October 1st. And he, in every meeting, stressed, if the website is not terrific, the best first rate, then nothing is going to work.
Did the president push back on her? I mean, that's a management 101.
Yeah. We got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. If you're a Democrat, have we been too rough on the president? And if you are a Republican, let me ask you this question. What we're talking about tonight, is it more about a broken promise, or is it about a broken presidency that's never going to get back on track again? Your opinion, we're looking for it. Back shortly. From Burbank, California to Bradenton, Florida, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border. Nice to have you with us. During the break, Khalil, you were saying you do not agree with at least the question I asked, whether or not we're dealing with a broken presidency right now, that this is going to be very difficult for this president to get beyond this perception now of the incompetence of his administration as it relates to the rollout and the website. It's more than just the website. It's, as you say, not being ready to not ready for prime time.
Sure.
When they have plenty of time to lead up to it. And it's going to be hard to get anybody to take him seriously when he says anything, because there is now this difference, not only difference of opinion, you have them on tape saying one thing, and the American people now know, I mean millions of people now know, that that was not the truth.
But look, to compare the president, this president, to George W. Bush, mission accomplished, or you know the elder Bush talking about read my lips, no new taxes, misses the point. The point is that 87% of Americans will not be impacted one iota by this statement that we're taking issue with. So you have 13% of Americans, and I'm not dismissive of those 13% of Americans. I think they should be able to keep their bad plan if they want to keep their bad plan. I mean, that's what they were
promised. But 13% of the people.
Yeah.
We do not know how many of those 13%.
Yeah.
Let me just finish my point.
Yes.
They voted for him. They voted to reelect him.
Sure.
Because they believed him. And they were not told the truth.
That's
right. They probably would like to have their vote back.
They would. But look, this is not something that cannot be undone. This is something that can be undone if we can grandfather those plans in, right? Congress should act.
You're dealing with a congressional thing. I'm dealing with a perception about whether or not you can't take a falsehood or a lie back.
No, you can't.
You can.
No. And it does undermine. I always – country first. I want the country to do well. I want the president to do well because that means the country does well.
Thank you.
And I can't trust this man. He doesn't seem to know what's going on. He doesn't know what's going on with NSA. He doesn't know what's going on with the website. He didn't even realize that this lie was a lie until they told him, and he continued to tell the lie. Mm-hmm. Why should I believe anything he tells me?
Well, I think that gets to Bruce's point. You know, if the president's now going to try to tackle some other big issues, immigration being the one he's thrown out recently – and we know how hard, what a hard lift that is in general, and how controversial and tough that will be. Who's going to believe anything he says about what's in his plan?
Right.
Especially
people,
with the controversial aspects of it.
People want to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I think that if this web plan on November 30th is up and running and he has this burst of the techie guys we should have had, instead he gave right after it passed Congress, he gave it to his political and his policy people. And that was a big mistake. Instead of going out and finding somebody who could do the best startup on the planet. But I think if that website starts working, I think the American people have a very short attention
span.
I don't think it ruins his presidency. I think the website
is just one part of this. Yes. I mean, I think what Bruce is talking about is the president's credibility, and are people going to have confidence in what he says and how he wants to lead? And I think that's a much bigger problem than a website now.
Why would Merkel have confidence in what he has to say?
Because we spy on every other leader
because Germans probably spy on us too, not on his cell phone. Why would she
trust anything that Barack Obama said?
I think on the foreign policy front, this president has lost a lot of credibility. I think we've lost credibility.
Ask the Saudis, all over the entire Middle East.
I think as what presidents desperately want is to be a two-term president. And I think if these things had happened before the end of his first term, he would have never been able to win re-election. Oh. But now what he's got to do is what Bill Clinton did when he was in the throes of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. He's got to start thinking about his legacy, and he's got to start thinking about his library. But you remember, just about a week ago, he started talking, as John said, about the bringing immigration to the fore. I don't think that has a snowball's chance in hell of going anywhere
You also have to remember, I mean, immigration, for example, he still has to deal with issues. He still has to deal with being president. He still has to deal with Congress.
Right.
And what happened this week was a lot of hand-wringing among Democrats in Congress who are furious about the rollout of the website, about these kind of statements, about the actual impact on their constituents. So now his own allies are telling him to get his act together.
Well, what's going to happen is you're going to have constituents, just as happened to Dan Rostenkowski, who is one of the most popular Democrats and most powerful Democrats. And again, when he was on the wrong side of a political issue, grandmas and grandmas, they would jump on his car.
Yeah.
And I assume that that's the type of heat that a lot of members of Congress are getting now.
And
just the complaint about the website, when they get into some of the specifics and they find out their rates are going up,
they're
going to be
more mad
as hell, and they're going to take it out on their local congressman.
They're going to take it out on their congressman. And also remember that, you know, the president is heading into the lame duck part of his presidency. You're going to have another congressional election. You know, certainly, you know, I'll be the first to admit that the Republicans have not distinguished themselves in the last few months, but, you know, it certainly plays on the Republican, to the Republicans' advantage in this congressional election. You've got senators like Senator Pryor in Arkansas or Senator Begich in Alaska who are running in red Democrats running in very red states.
Mary
Landrieu in Louisiana. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them.
She's walking this back, and she voted not to along with a lot of her Democratic colleagues, not to grandfather those plans. So she's in trouble.
But they're going
to
start backing away from the president now because their own political future is at stake.
Let's go to Tom listening to us in Youngstown, Ohio, on WKBN. Nice to hear from the Big 57 tonight. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce, to your guest. In my opinion, Obama's doing the job of two presidents. He's combined the deceit, manipulation, and moral corruption of Richard Nixon with the incompetency of Jimmy Carter. When you consider his lack of leadership, foreign and domestic, Benghazi, Fast and Furious, the IRS scandal, the Obamacare rollout disaster, the stalled economy, the deficit, or debt, I should say, the AP wiretaps, and even the spitefulness during the shutdown where he was putting up barriers to the vets going to the memorial and Mount Rushmore and so forth. I think when you combine all that together, Hillary Clinton 3 years from now is going to be in the same position as Jeb Bush was when George W. Bush left office.
Tom, stay right where you are because you've laid a lot out there, and I'm going to let our Democrat to jump in and engage you in conversation.
You know,
where is he wrong? Where is Tom wrong?
He's wrong in the sense that it's getting really tiring to hear people throwing names around like Nixon and Carter and calling this president names. And really, frankly, there's so many people out there that want this president to fail. It almost has become a mantra, right? So anytime I hear somebody like Tom saying that, with all due respect, Tom, good evening, I don't agree with you. I fundamentally do not agree with you. And I think that it's easier to call this president names like that. It's easier to basically, you know, name drop like Fast and Furious and this and that. But let's look at two things, Tom. And I enjoin you as a fellow American, Republican or Democrat, right, to basically look at the good of the country, to basically first and foremost give our presidents, whether it's George W. Bush or Barack Obama, first and foremost, the benefit of the doubt. I'm seeing a poisonous atmosphere in this country where we've gotten into name-calling, where all we have basically is people that are hating on President Obama, hating on our previous president, President Bush, and really not looking at the task that needs to be done. The country's in crisis. Let's think about ways to fix the economy, to fix healthcare, instead of just coming up with all these names to call this president.
John.
Well, you know, I think it's also important to have accountability. And it doesn't matter who the president is.
We should have accountability.
And I think, you know, Tom just went through a laundry list of scandals. And frankly, I would say the opposite. I think there's a structure in this country that protects this president. And I think it's the media. And I think it's some of his wealthy donors and Wall Street and all this.
The media? Look how we're skewering him. How is the media protecting this president?
Well, we're not the mainstream media right here. And frankly,
I'm going to give you one example of how the media protects him. Did you watch Meet the Press today?
Yeah, and I watched 60 Minutes last week.
All right, fine. All right. When you're watching David Gregory today, and he's interviewing Mitt Romney, okay? When Mitt Romney is attacking the administration and the Affordable Care Act and ripping it apart,
yeah.
It seems to me today that David Gregory went overboard in trying to convince Mitt Romney where he was wrong and what the Obama administration really wanted to do. He was going through chapter and verse and this and that, and this is how it was differing from was I the only one
I noticed it, but I don't think people respect David Gregory that much, and I think that's why his ratings are going down. But
he was like cheerleader.
He was, but he often is, and today's not the first time, but there was a very fascinating long piece in the Washington Post, front page story today, and basically what the point of it was is that the Obama administration was so afraid of being skewered and attacked by Republicans from 1910 up until October 1, 2013, when this thing was rolled out, that they were making all kinds of boneheaded decisions. They had charts that they didn't want to go public because they were afraid that Fox News would be showing them on
charts,
the air and saying, this is impossibly complicated. They couldn't appropriate the proper amounts of money because they didn't want to be called on it by Congress. So there was such a poisonous, such a toxic atmosphere that it was like a cloud enveloped the White White House, and they couldn't move. And it's like one of those dreams where you can't get to your destination. I imagine Obama had a lot of
them. Don't you think that says a lot about this administration? I mean,
it says a lot about the country and the Republican Party, too.
Just the obsession with secrecy and the idea that they're always right and everybody else is wrong, and that we can't share information, we can't have a collaborative process because someone's going to attack us.
Because of the poison out there. That's why this administration has been very protective.
They create
how
that
is, how is this poison any different than the poison that was out there for President Bush?
Precisely. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing, only it's the political atmosphere.
There is one big difference, and that is Barack Obama's inability to make coalitions and to bring people together. That's the one thing that Ronald Reagan was terribly polarizing. I was just a young professor at the time, and I was moving from being a Democrat to Republican at the time. I almost feared the man. But he could bring people together. Barack Obama is totally incapable of doing that. And I think that's why I think Bruce is right that this is the end for his administration.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Is this the end of the Obama administration insofar as efficiency, effectiveness, and... Did he deliver on the promise he made in that very first speech when he became a household word? Back shortly. From Sausalito, California to Sarasota, Florida, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Time now for each of our guests to introduce themselves. We begin with Khalil Marar.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Bruce. My name is Khalil Marar. I am an author of a book called The Arab Lobby, U.S. Foreign Policy, a forthcoming book. I'm at Governor State University, an assistant professor, helping set up a new undergraduate program that we have in political and justice studies. Exciting times there, exciting times here, and I look forward to talking about the issues tonight.
John McGovern, I'm one of our Republicans.
Thanks, Bruce. I'm John McGovern. I'm an executive vice president with Resolute Consulting, a national public affairs firm based here in Chicago. For over 20 years, I've worked on a number of congressional and state Republican political campaigns and worked for former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert for 8 years.
Yeah, you were his principal spokesperson. Yep. Very, very good. Carol Felsenthal, step up to the microphone and tell everybody who you are.
I am a journalist, and I've been a freelance journalist since the late 1970s. I write book-length biographies. The most recent of my favorite character in the world, Bill Clinton, called Clinton in Exile, a look at his life out of the White House. I think he'll soon be going back into the White House. And Catherine Graham, the publisher and the owner of the Washington Post, are two of them. I blog for Chicago Magazine and for the Hill newspaper in Washington at the moment.
Mike Miller.
And Mike Miller. I'm an economist, associate professor at DePaul University. I've been there for 33 years, and I am a proud Republican, but I'm an economist first. So whenever I hear some of these issues, I think from the economic side first. And my research would put you to sleep. It's on the economy of Bahrain.
Let's go to Joe, listening to us on the Internet tonight from Los Angeles. Go ahead, Joe. Nice to hear from California.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Okay.
I'm a 27-year-old, and I honestly... I'm not going to be buying health insurance. I have no desire. I'm really young. And
Joe, you're under arrest.
Well, I mean, here's my whole thing is, you know, what is $95 fine to me at the end of the day?
It's
and
not,
I don't have a lot of, I don't have any equity built up. I make $14 an hour. I mean, if I have to go to the doctor for something like an emergency, if I'm in an accident, if it bankrupts me, it's really not the end of the world, as bad as that sounds. I mean, I don't really care. I mean, it's going to be a lot more painful to me if I have to make these monthly payments that I really not going to need. I mean, I've never spent the night in the hospital ever. I mean, never.
This is exactly why the system, even if the website starts to work, why the system is probably doomed to fail, because it is people like Joe who absolutely have to sign up to subsidize the program. To take care of the old and the poor.
People call the young and invincible.
And this is called adverse selection. The only people who are going to it now, apparently in some of the states, 80 to 85% of all the people are signing up for Medicaid, which means they pay no premiums. You and I as taxpayers, we pay the whole thing.
Sure.
It is going to fail.
In the state of Oregon, zero people signed up for one of the plans on the exchange, and I think 64,000
signed up for Medicaid.
That's but
correct.
You know what's interesting about people like Joe, and as you say, he's called an invincible.
It's the males
who are the invincibles, not his peers, same age females. Right. They're more likely to be insured, but he has to pay a fine, and then it gets all connected to the IRS.
But
right?
even if he pays $95,
well, let's be careful. Joe's assumption that it's $95. Is incorrect if he makes above a certain amount because it's 1%.
He makes $14 an hour. He doesn't make
$95, whatever comes first.
We can't get into the specific of every caller that came in, but Joe, thanks for your advice. Let's go to John in Wheaton, Illinois, on our flagship station, WLS.
Hi.
Hi.
Question that I have, or the comment that I have, is that so far the panel seems to be missing the real nature of the underlying why that was put forth on the question of can you keep your health insurance. And it's not whether any given individual could keep their insurance or not. What it really is about is this. When the Affordable Care Act was under discussion, the concern was that this would be a government takeover of medicine. And when Obama said, no, you're going to get to keep your plan. If you like it, you're going to keep your doctor, he was implicitly saying that the individual would be the primary decision maker, the primary focus of his own health care. Under the Affordable Care Act, the government is now the primary decision maker. When they say you can't keep your plan, there may be some plans that are not good, but that is not the driving point. Consider a woman who's 59, had a hysterectomy, and chose not to have pregnancy coverage. Her plan may cover every conceivable medical need she may have, but her plan will not be acceptable because it doesn't serve a greater social good.
That's right.
That is, more people providing people in the pool so that pregnancy coverage is cheaper for someone else. So the fundamental shift, which he denied during the campaign, was the individual would remain the heart of the health care debate, and now it's the government that's going to make the fundamental decisions, and the individual is being reduced to a bit player. Right. And it doesn't matter if it's 5% or 10% or if some plans are good or bad. It's a fundamental shift from individual control of your own life to the government control.
John, thanks very much. Carol, did you want to make a comment about
the woman with the hysterectomy? One of the other plans, I mean, I like the idea of it, but she also has to pay for maternity care,
as do
males. And, you know, when I think about this, the famous line that came from Nancy Pelosi during the passage, we have to pass it to know what's in it.
Yeah,
that was a screaming warning because the plan really is a hot mess.
But I think John makes a good point that this is the statement that the president made that we're talking about tonight was a political statement.
Yes.
It was not a policy statement.
No.
It was a political statement.
Yes.
And it was made
like read my lips, no new taxes.
Yeah.
Well, right. But I mean, those are the kind of statements that get people in trouble when they turn out not to be true.
Those are the statements they're made to swing votes, to get votes. And if your ability to deliver those messages and those messages are believed, then you're asking for a vote, and it's a bogus request.
And let's remember that President Obama is a lawyer. This is his argument. This was the argument he's making to the public about why this should be accepted. And he's going to say whatever is in his mind, and it's going to advance his cause.
Just as the Republicans were talking about death panels and things like that, I mean, let's not focus on this statement in a vacuum. The truth is, President Obama was responding to a litany of criticisms of death panels and you know, like socialism and socialized medicine and all that stuff.
People weren't buying it. People didn't believe it.
This is exactly
But people did not believe it.
If you look
people
at the
did,
nature...
People did believe...
And the
when
people
you look
who
at
the, said
they did
that,
believe this.
The people,
they did believe this.
And the people who said that were not the authors of the legislation. It was not their policy.
When you look at the nature of the political debate, the mired political debate, the myopic political debate that was taking place when President Obama made that statement, there was an entire context, and one, frankly, that was full of omissions, of lies, of half-truths, of hysteria.
I think that's right. And you don't hear about death panels anymore.
Exactly,
that's
you don't hear about death panels.
That's a phrase that doesn't come up.
And the truth is, you know, all this hot mess.
Because the American people were not voting on that particular subject. They did that was not a term that was used by Mitt Romney and the campaign.
That's right.
It was not.
No, it was Michelle Bachmann.
It was Michelle Bachmann.
And she was not a significant player.
No, she wasn't.
When she said it, she certainly wasn't a significant player later.
There are a lot of people who like the single-payer simplicity, and I count myself among them, but it's going to look pretty – a single-payer is going to look pretty good compared to –
I want to switch gears.
We'll take some calls in just a moment. But another big story of this week, and in fact it became a bigger story, when the new book Double Down came out, and this was by the same authors that did Game Change 4 years ago. They covered this the recent campaign between Romney and Obama. The book came out, and one of the revelations in the book, which you've done some research on, was a suggestion that there was a move afoot by some to dump Joe Biden from the ticket because they thought the ticket was going down in flames. Mm. And you've done some research because Bill Daley was an integral part of that plot.
Right. I really believe that Bill Daley was a force behind that. So he...
Who was Joe Biden's, one of his best friends for 30 years.
For 30 years, these guys are best friends, are... Not best friends, but best political friends. They're Irish Catholic. They both had a tragedy in their lives. Each one of them lost a child. They had this great bond.
Now, Bill didn't lose a child. Rich lost a child.
No, Bill Daley did, too. Bill Daley did, too.
I never
heard
that.
Yes, and Bill Daley lost a son to, I think, a congenital disease. But the Bill Daley goes to the White House's chief of staff, things aren't going well, and he's pushed out of the White House by Obama because he's so ineffectual, and he comes up with this idea, and he believes it because Obama's ratings in 2011 were sinking as they are now, and he pushes it, and then he talks to these reporters because he likes to talk to the really important political reporters like the two who wrote Double Down and Game Change, and in the meantime, he's in the gubernatorial race here, and I won't get too much in the weeds about that, but in a really petulant and irresponsible way, he drops out of the race after he changed the entire configuration of the race so that the Democrats are now left with only one candidate on their side. And he leaves the race, and then soon thereafter, he gets appointed by CBS as a political contributor. When the New York Times calls him to ask him about it, he spills all the beans to the New York Times in a very bold and emphatic way, and then
how serious was it? I mean, this is we're getting into the weeds. How serious was this? Do you think it was really serious?
No, I think it was. I think it was a Bill Daley idea, and I think that they did focus group.
But he said that they talked about. They talked about a lot of things.
Right, right.
He basically said. When the boat's going down, you look for all kinds of ways to save yourself.
I think this is an exaggerated story. I mean,
we're going to come back. I want to hear your side of it when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. We'll have callers. We'll hear from them when we come back as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. John, you were going to make another point about Bill Daley and this. You don't think it's a big story?
I think it's an exaggerated story. I mean, for all the incompetence of this White House, they do know how to run a campaign, and it certainly makes sense to test everything. And I would have been shocked if they hadn't tested. That would have been a more interesting question. And if you remember, back at the time, there were stories all in the New York Times, in the Washington Post. There was tons of speculation about a potential switch. I mean, I don't think anyone's surprised to learn that they would at least look at it. And you know, I think that's the interesting thing about these books, these kind of campaign tell-all books that come out. You know, the very orchestrated way that these tidbits are packaged and fed out to improve.
Yeah, the book hasn't even been published.
Well, that's
yet.
My point. Yeah. To generate, so we're all talking about it. Uh-huh. And it's these books. You know, you look at the sourcing and the footnoting, or lack thereof, and, you know, you start to wonder where some of this stuff comes from.
Carol, what you have a final point on
Right. Well, the reason that it is such a big story is because people are immensely interested in Hillary. And but Bill Daley
the
gives us
American journalists are
well, okay, female journalists in particular. But but he gives us.
And we know how far they moved her last time.
He gives the interview to the New York Times, and he's really emphatic, and it's really sounds like a big story. And then I imagine the people from CBS News called him and said, "Why are you giving this scoop to the New York Times? You're our contributor." So the next morning he goes on with Charlie Rose and the co-anchor whose name is Nora O'Donnell, maybe? But anyway, he goes on with the two of them, and he walks it back about as fast as he can go, and then he says, it was never a plan, it was never going to be done. You know, positive, positive, positive. He ends a sentence with period. And when I hear that, oh boy, this guy is tone deaf.
Well, also let's we got somebody that wants to talk about another television appearance today of Rahm Emanuel's brother. Let's go to Isla, listening to us in Cedar Lake, Indiana, on WLS. Go ahead, Ida.
Isla, yes, hi. I've not heard anyone talk about the policy advisor to President Obama on health care, and it's Rahm Emanuel's brother, doctor. His first name is very
Ezekiel,
hard to pronounce.
Ezekiel Emanuel. He was on television today, yes.
Anyways, he wrote a paper, and he's written papers on his philosophy or ideology about the complete life system. In 2009, he published a paper on the principles for allocation of scarce medical intervention, and he believes that the health care money should be spent on ages 15 to 40. And if a 20-year-old, he said in his papers, if a 20-year-old person dies, that's more of a problem than a baby dying, because money has been spent by the parents to educate that person, and the schools have educated him, but a baby has not received any of that type of
See,
money.
There you go.
So what is your point, Isla?
My point is that he talks about the fact there will be scarce resources, and there will be, if you're 65, you've had your chance. So there will be death penalties.
This is exactly
made by the government on who is going to get
Thanks. You made your point. Go ahead.
This is exactly the kind of fear-mongering that took place that forced the president's hand in making that statement. Look, I'm not defending Barack Obama's lie. All I'm saying is that when you have a context that basically talks about Isla's point,
you finally called it a lie 45 minutes into the show.
It's not a lie unless he actually intended it to be a lie. It might be an omission. It might be a half-truth. It might be an unknown.
So George Bush never lied.
Here's the point. Instead of us talking about how this president lied, why don't we talk about what the best solution is to the health care crisis that we have in this country? When people talk about the premiums,
we're trying to do that now.
People talk about their premiums going up, whether it's 12% or 24% or 57%. It was going up in 1/6 of the sector in general, right? This is 1/6 of the economy, of the American economy, right? It was skyrocketing compared to everything else with the exception of education. The question is, how do we bring costs down? And nobody is answering that question.
We're going to John listening to us in Chicago. Go ahead, John.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I wanted to preface my statement before by saying I'm not sure who said it, but because of the way she handled the whole Benghazi thing, Hillary Clinton will not see the White House. Second of all, I wanted to say that the reason why this president, who originally was a community organizer, can't seem to get the country on the same page as far as Democrat and Republican. I've never seen us so divided, and that's why nothing gets done. And that's why I don't think anything will get done, whether it's called immigration, whether it's called health care reform, whether you call it whatever you want, neither side wants to budge. And this is unprecedented, in I think, in the country's history, almost as far as like how much each side doesn't want to accommodate the other.
We were pretty divided under President Bush, too, right? So this is just a continuation of that division.
But the difference
is it's not a negation of that division.
The difference I see it is, and regardless of you know where you fall on whether you like or believe any of these people, but you know President Bush wanted to lead. Now, maybe he had a hard time getting people to follow him.
What does that mean? I don't even know what that means anymore.
He had a vision, and he wanted to execute it. This president doesn't want to lead.
Two wars and an economic recession.
Well, now you're making the kind of poisonous comments that you were just lecturing us all again.
My point is that the president had a vision.
He had a vision. And like I said, you may disagree with it, but the point is he wanted to lead. He had a place he wanted to take the country. You may not like it, and you might disagree with it.
President Obama has a place he wants to take the country, too.
He doesn't want to engage with anyone.
President Obama has a place that he wants to take the country.
With the public, he doesn't want to engage with Congress. He doesn't want to lead us forward. He makes a mandate, or he makes a statement. Congress is not in charge of leading.
All you have to do is look at Britain. They have death panels because they have to decide what to do with their limited resources.
On that note, we are out of time. On that pleasant note of death panels, we're going to say farewell. To John McGovern and also to Mike Miller. They will be back for the next hour. Also, our thanks to Khalil Morar and the ever popular, always with us, always delightful, although she will not be with us for the next hour because she has another engagement, Carol Felsenthal. Carol, thanks very much for being with us.
Bruce.
I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly with another full hour if you're listening to us on radio. And if you're watching this program on television in the city of Chicago, we will see you next week. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Khalil Morar, John McGovern, Mike Miller, and Tom Scher. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base, at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And in this portion of our show, we're going to be talking about, we're going to give each of our guests an opportunity to talk about something that is near and dear to their heart that may not get the exposure that certainly the major Sunday shows deal with. And Professor Mike Miller, you are with us. And Mike Miller is unique. He's from DePaul University, which doesn't make him unique. He's been there for about 33 years. But you are a Republican, and you're pleased to announce that you're a Republican. Mm-hmm. You used to be a Democrat, came from Pittsburgh.
Yep.
And you want to talk about what? There's some injustice that you deal with, and what is it?
It's been the change in universities over the past couple of decades, moving towards a single voice, and that voice is on the left, and that the faculty reflects this single voice. The surveys were taken of faculty years ago when I was in college in the 70s and in graduate school in the 70s. When they did surveys of faculty, they found that it was almost evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, or liberals and conservatives, with a bunch of independents in the middle as well. Nowadays, it's not that way at all. In some departments, you'll find, especially in the humanities and some of the social sciences, you will find that, say, in a faculty of 20, 19, maybe all 20 will be Democrats. None of them will be Republicans. Even in places like the B School, which I am over at DePaul, I know many people say that the business schools are full of conservatives and that's offset by what happens in the humanities. That's not the case. I have many beloved colleagues. I like them a whole lot, but they are on the left. They are liberal, democratic professors. And the big problem is that students don't oftentimes hear another voice. And the faculty themselves are almost never challenged by another point of view. And I think that stilts the education.
Khalil Morar, you're a professor as well. Do you agree with that? You teach at Governor's State. Do you agree with that assessment?
You know, I agree that there is a slant towards the left in academics. I don't know. I mean, I haven't been at anywhere for that long of a time, so I wouldn't know the evolution or what the perspectives are out there. But I do agree that it does tend towards the left, and there's a reason for that. I mean, the left, I think, traditionally has maintained that the realm of the intellect and the realm of academics is something that we ought to be engaged in. Not necessarily that, you know, that the right doesn't believe that either, but it does slant towards the left. I agree with that part of it.
Well, I think what happened is Mike didn't use the word that no Republican likes to use, and Khalil didn't use it because it's not used often enough in that type of context, and that is the word progressive. There's liberal, there's left, there's far left, there's center of left. Nobody wants to use the word progressive. And I think generally, as Khalil alluded to briefly, in any academic setting, you have educated people who can see down the line and who are interested in progress. If you look at the conservatives in this country, in our history, from day one, they have been interested in status quo, no change, no progress. Thus, they're not progressives. So I would think that Professor Miner is completely correct that universities are more progressive, and most of your progressives, not all, but 90% of them are Democrats.
John McGovern is a Republican. Wow. Now, he's a media guy. We could have this same conversation about the media that we're having about academia, but speak to those fighting words that Tom Scherer just threw on the table.
Well, I'd like to say some of the greatest thought has come from conservatives, maybe going in a different direction than what you might like. But I think one of the things that Mike brought up is a very important point, which I think is it's not whether they're all Democrat or progressive or liberal. The point is they're all one voice. And that, you know, a university, especially for undergraduates, is supposed to be an opportunity to expand your mind. It's to learn new things, to be challenged, to hear different voices. If you only hear one view, if you are bombarded by a consistent ideology and agenda, one, I think it's hard for people to feel empowered to push back because they feel isolated and they feel not supported and they're not encouraged. And I think it also, to your point, it's a stultifying atmosphere. I think it doesn't bring forth the creativity and the debate.
Just for the record, I did not and do not advocate a huge slant one way or the other. And I agree with you. I do decry any lack of balance in voices, plural. If that's the case, and we don't have any quantifiable proof.
Mike's point is, where do you get that balance in a college or university setting?
Well, we don't know that balance doesn't exist. That's just Mike's take on DePaul University, from what I can tell.
I think that most people would say that in most have been colleges, done. Universities, they are left of center, Tom.
And Tom,
I'm just saying that throughout history, the haves want status quo. They don't want change. They don't want progress. They like things just the way they are. And for them, I'm sure it works fine. But
certain types of people go into academia,
well,
and
see,
are they
this
more?
Is the problem. And that's one of the arguments now, is that the reason it's become this way is because conservatives want money, and secondly, because conservatives are stupid. And you all but said that. That's
exactly. Sorry. Say that again. Please repeat that.
Conservatives want money more than the academy offered. So they want to be lawyers and people who make lots of money.
Oh, more than academia.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And that the right are stupid.
Says whom?
The left.
Oh, really? And the right never says the left is stupid.
It's just me. It's not just me. Okay. One of my habits is I go on every single morning. There's a website called Minding the Campus, and there's one called Inside Higher Ed. Mm-hmm. These are like the Chronicle of Higher Ed, and I look at them every day, and one thing I look at are comments about articles, and invariably, conservative professors are referred to as being stupid. You could see
it. By whom? By people who choose to get on websites and log on?
Yeah.
I do believe that whether it's liberal, progressive, left, I do believe there is an air of superiority.
Absolutely. Both moral as well as intellectual.
They can make decisions for people better than the people can make their decisions. People who disagree with them are not smart.
Yep.
They're not up to standards.
I think that this,
and by the way, and of course, they have no compassion
That's
for the
right.
poor.
And well, one I, last point I want to make.
Well, I may be one of the few Democrats you'll have on this show who has a lot of staunchly conservative Republican friends with whom I talk all the time. And everything you just said, whether true or not of those left of center, I can assure you is true of many and most people I know who are right of center. They think the liberals are stupid.
I do not believe that conservatives think liberals are stupid.
No.
I don't think they talk about their intellect, their lack of knowledge,
nope.
their lack of interest in the arts or anything. What they do talk about, this is what conservatives talk about, is they talk about they're not responsible with their money. And they also talk about another thing, that really there is an air of superiority about them. They do talk about that. But I don't think they talk down to them and say that they're stupid. Or they're naive. They think a lot of liberals are naive. They want to save the world. They want to make the world better. But they don't think far enough down the road to understand the consequences of all the good work that they try to do.
I suppose we'd have to define the term stupid. Does that mean lacking in intelligence? Lacking in education?
Yes. Who would be surprised?
Okay. I don't hear.
Even listen, I would be shocked.
I would not describe myself as a flaming liberal, not at all, not even close. And you've heard me on this show. I'm left of center, but not that far left. I don't know any liberals who don't admit that if it takes money, it takes brains to build a company and make money. And if a lot of Republicans...
if you're a liberal, if you're a conservative, how do you describe those people who disagree with you? And when we come back, we're going to talk about another topic. We'll talk about media, but we'll also talk about another topic. Back shortly. From Biloxi, Mississippi to Bradenton, Florida, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Khalil Morar, it's now your turn. Step up, Governor State University. This is your segment. What's the pet topic you want to get off your chest?
The division that we have in this country, it's poisonous on both sides, both left and right. You know, I came to this country, Bruce, in 1987, and I saw a country of innovators. I saw a country of people that really want to do things. I saw a workshop for a democracy. I saw ideas being brought to the forefront to change, right, what is broken and to keep in place.
Who poisoned the well?
I think we're poisoning ourselves. You know, I've always said this to my students and anybody that's willing to listen, that the United States of America is its greatest adversary, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, that we are our worst critics and we will basically destroy this country if we maintain a posture that I've seen in recent years, especially in the last decade, of divisiveness, of hatred, of venomous dispositions, of people just basically hating one another and coming up with problems and not talking enough about solutions.
When you say hate, what about just the difference between liberals and conservatives?
It's a good difference.
We live in a divided country. We live in a country that a year ago it reelected Barack Obama.
Correct.
And it elected a Republican House.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So there's differences. And it maybe it's 50-50, yeah. Maybe it's 48-52. How are you going to change that? Why should people change the things they believe just because someone who they voted for didn't win?
Look,
why should they change?
That's a great point, right? And I used to tell this to my left-leaning students, right? Let the man govern, about George W. Bush.
I agree with that.
I will say it to my right-wing students. Let the man govern, about President Barack Obama. Whatever happened to respecting your president? Whatever happened to respecting the office of the presidency? Whatever happened to giving the guy the benefit of the doubt? Whatever happened to coming up with solutions instead of more problems? You know, I've heard tonight an entire hour of problems about the Affordable Care Act, about Obamacare, whatever the heck you want to call it. Why aren't people coming up with solutions? And if the Republican Party was so into resolving one-sixth
of the economy...
The president's
opponents do not want solutions.
No, but the point... Let's go beyond it. Let's talk about let's focus on the poisoning of the well.
Yeah.
You say the well has been poisoned,
yeah.
and there are people out there who are professional Obama haters.
Yes.
Okay? There were professional George Bush haters.
Yes,
okay?
There were.
Different group.
Well, there were professional John Adams haters and professional Thomas Jefferson haters.
It's factions.
But also, by the way, a word that we didn't use much in our recent conversation was the word lie. Okay?
Yeah. Correct.
But here's something. It was Ted Kennedy, when George Bush was looking like he was going to be reelected, it was Ted Kennedy that brought the suggestion and put it in the national debate,
right,
that George Bush had lied to the American people about the war in Iraq. Lied. He used the L word.
Yeah.
That's not a word that politicians generally use.
Right.
But Ted Kennedy was the one that put that word in the body politic.
Are you saying that's when it really started to turn?
I do believe that's when the level of venom picked up.
Well, here's my take on it, Bruce. And,
it goes back
this.
To Bork. I mean, Bork well, was the first say. Of it. And Clarence Thomas. Supreme it goes Bork. Back to...
I think Bork in 1987 was the first of it. I really believe that. But when it really picked... First of all, the calling George Bush a liar on the war was eclipsed 10 times over by how many times Barack Obama was called a liar on his own birth
That's
certificate
right.
issue.
That's right.
That said,
but that was fringe. That was definitely fringe.
I didn't know Donald Trump was fringe, but I guess he's fringe.
I would say so.
All right.
I would say
right. so. But Fox News isn't
my
fringe.
Neighbor.
Fox News has a tremendous reach, and they said it day and night. That said, the Bork thing absolutely huge. But where it really turned was in 1992. Yes. Bill Clinton was elected president with less than 50% of the vote, and the Republican Party, extreme and non-extreme, decided this man is not a legitimately elected president, and we will not treat him as such.
That's right.
And that's where it really, really turned. And then when Clinton got elected again, now it's we got to get this White House back in 4 years, so we're just going to keep doing what we do.
See,
and then Barack Obama got elected.
John, you were on the inside during
that's politics. I mean, that's presidential politics.
But it was never
and
like
nobody
this
said he was illegitimate president. I mean, he won.
Who didn't say that? The 90% of his opponents said it.
Oh, come on. I don't know who you were talking to or listening to.
No, I don't. I do not remember the level of venom. In fact, granted, there was a philosophical difference between Gingrich and Clinton, but they both sort of needed each other. They both needed each other as a foil. But I don't think it was a level of hatred. There was much more hatred towards
Ronald
Newt
Reagan.
Gingrich and Ronald Reagan during this.
Ronald Reagan had Democratic cooperation for various legislation. The Ronald Reagan thing didn't turn until Iran Contra.
But Dan
Rostenkowski and all that.
That's
it is true.
I think
John.
I think you can go back farther than Bork. I think you can go back to Lyndon Johnson. You go back to the Vietnam War. I mean, I think that's when people began to lose confidence and in their government.
But
government started to have a credibility problem with its own people.
But I think Bruce is right. It really, really turned. And I'll tell you another thing that turned it up. When you could make money by being politically biased in a news organization,
yes.
Fox News really changed the debate. That created MSNBC,
yes.
Which makes money not nearly as much on the left side.
Right.
CNN is in the
CNN
middle.
CNN trying,
they don't know what the heck to do. And I'll tell you something else. I deal every day with media. I still do. I've been a consultant for years. I'm a director of communication for years. And I have now seen it bleed down into the day-to-day news coverage where the reporters are furthering a political agenda. Now, all the Republicans at this table will say, well, that's been happening for years, the liberal media.
Yep.
The conservative media has never been more powerful. It is in the mainstream. It happens all the time. And that's been a big change in the
John,
debate.
John, would you agree with that?
Is the media now is taking sides.
Well, that's true.
Well, but I think that's always been true.
Oh, and more so now than ever.
Well, I think it's if you want to point to conservative news outlets, I don't see what the problem with conservatives having a voice through the media.
Ah, I agree with you. If it's a talk show like Bill O'Reilly, yes. But when it's day-to-day news coverage in the general news hole, I don't think there's any place for bias.
Well,
on either side.
Well, I don't know what you've been reading or listening to for the last 40 years.
Fox News, and I've been reading
Mike Miller.
Every network, the New York Times.
Mike Miller.
Two things. There was a study done by some folks at Nonpartisan, and they looked at the straight news. And they found that the two most balanced straight news people were NPR during their news broadcast and Fox News. With Brett Baer and people like that. It was extreme. It was right down the line, straightforward news. O'Reilly and so forth, of course that's biased. The same with MSNBC. But when you look at straight news, NPR. Now, one last thing about Khalil as well. Mm-hmm. The one thing that's different, though, you talk about the U.S. as this wonderful place. I happen to agree with that. I believe that the current president is embarrassed about America. He does not think the same way.
How do you know that?
Because he said, he talks about we don't have to go into the universities and ask and try to even begin to talk about American exceptionalism. Don't even try to talk about
America. He said America is an exceptional place over and over and over again. He really believes
Bill
it. He wouldn't
Ayers
have become president
so
of the United States
of
America.
Calls. Greg in Schaumburg, Illinois on WLS Radio. Welcome to this little Donnybrook we're having. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I can. You sound great.
Okay, very good. You've covered a lot of what I wanted to say. First thing, to Mark Miller's point, as a father of someone who just put their two kids through school, it's a lot worse. And to portray that, Khalil, the kid walking into your classroom right now is not Michael J. Fox from Family Ties in the 80s wearing a suit and willing to confront you. They don't even feel they have a shot in your classroom, so they just shut up. And the thing about it,
come to my class.
They're so passive.
Come to my class and see. That's not true.
It is in many classes.
I don't agree with you. I see it, and it's all across.
And my thought, my suggestion to you, sir, my suggestion to you, sir, as a person who raised two children who I would describe as left of center, one of whom works in the banking industry, all around him are decidedly right of center, and he's learning a lot of things that he didn't realize about the world, conservatively speaking. My advice to you, sir, would be to raise your children to have some guts, to speak out and not be fearful. This is called the United States of America. We are not descended from fearful men and women.
Conservatives and liberals. My class speak out all the time. We have very flexible debates.
Go ahead, Greg.
Khalil, just to substantiate my point, the only thing that you've really contributed to the conversation tonight is that we are dealing with emotions. We've got to turn the emotions down. There are a ton of Republican ideas that have critiqued the health care plan, and you refuse to hear them, period.
That's exactly my point. That's exactly my point, is that we have too much critique and not enough solutions. We need to have solutions.
Let's go to Ray in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Go ahead, listening to us on WS. Ray, go ahead. Nice to hear from Michigan tonight.
Yes, what's being left out in this discussion, I believe, in regard to this president, is racism. Most of the conservative outrage is racism.
Most of it,
And the racism in the Republicans goes back at least to Ronald Reagan when he opened his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers were murdered. And his continued phraseology using the welfare queen mother and her Cadillac buying libs and everything with their food stamps. It leads up to today with the conservatives taking away food stamps from the poor, in which the poor were made by the Republicans and their minions in Wall Street. You know, that's the thing that's being left out with the conservatives. And I was
You know what also is being left out in your litany. And again, I want to let our guests respond. But what's also left out in your litany is the role that conservatives and primarily Republicans played significant role in passing the Voting Rights Bill in 1964. Okay? It was Republicans, conservatives, and moderates. And you know what? It was the Democrats who had their one foot of the 18th century. They were the ones, Southern Democrats. They were standing
I don't think it's fair to classify the Southern Democrats, the Democrats, as real Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
They ran.
Did FDR ever refused to take electoral votes from racist states in the South?
He needed those votes to pass his legislation, just as every Republican, including Mitt Romney, needs the Tea Party, fellas.
Now we're switching to that.
That's why the Democrats waited 30 years for the voting rights.
The Southern Democrats ran Strom Thurmond and George Wallace, for God's sake. You can't.
92% of blacks vote for Democrats.
You all fell for the bait.
George Bush was a...
From Madison, Wisconsin to Manitowoc, Wisconsin, you're listening to the Beltway Hybrids 2Bot. Thanks very much for being with us tonight. Time now for us all to speak and introduce ourselves. And Khalil Morar, we'll start with you.
My name is Khalil Morar. I'm author of Arab Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy, a book on foreign policy, and a forthcoming book on Middle East conflicts. I work at Governor State University in addition to teaching and researching and serving there. I'm helping head up a new undergraduate program that we have at Governor State University.
John McGovern.
I'm John McGovern. I'm Executive Vice President with Resolute Consulting, a national public affairs firm based here in Chicago. And for more than 20 years, I've been involved in Republican politics and campaigns and spent 8 years working for the former Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert.
Tom Scheer.
My name is Tom Scheer. I was a broadcast journalist for over 30 years and a media consultant for 5. I recently sold my company and became the Director of Communications for the Illinois Department of Corrections. And I am a Democrat, but a little more conservative than some other Democrats might be.
Mike Miller.
And I'm Mike Miller, Associate Professor of Economics, and I have the privilege of teaching economics to a lot of young minds.
And let's go to calls. Let's go to Kevin, listening to us in Elmhurst, Illinois, on WLS. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Great discourse, conversation this evening. This whole, the entire thing, I think, a lot of it goes back to Bork in 87. I interned in Washington, D.C. during that time, and I got to meet Mr. Bork at one point, but I just saw what happened there. It was so ugly what happened to to Bork. So I did some investigation, and I investigated Mr. Bork myself, and he was just a decent man, you know. And the way Ted Kennedy went after him was just, it was disgusting. And then after they went after, you know, when Justice Thomas, the same thing that happened there. I never saw Republicans ever go after a Democratic candidate, unless it was in the 70s during the Nixon period, which I'm too young to remember. But it was disgusting. It was really disgusting. And then we turn the page to, you know, to 2000, you know, the whole Bush-Gore thing. The Democrats never looked at Bush as being a legitimate president because of the whole decision in the Supreme Court. Okay, fine. I understand some of that point. But they just kept on harping on that and harping on that, doing investigation after investigation. Every major newspaper just about came out and found out that basically he would have won even if he had done several recounts, but that never stopped it. Then finally he had Iraq, and it just kind of built, this course has built up on the right, it's built up on the left, you know, on the left, built up on the right, but now we have this law, this Obamacare law, that actually was passed as a mandate, but then was upheld as a tax. So then you have the Supreme Court rewriting this entire law. So I think you have an entire nation right now that just, they've given up on both sides.
Well, I think your point's well stated. Thank you very much for your call. Now, let's go to John McGovern now. John, it's your turn to bring up a subject that you think that you want to get off your chest, that you talk about this and you worry about this and you're upset about this.
I'm very glad Tom's here because I appreciate his perspective on this. I'd like to discuss the changing nature of media coverage. One of the books that's in the news right now is Double Down, which is the campaign Romana Clef, I guess, if you could say, that's the successor to Game Change. And lots of interesting, titillating tidbits that get dripped out, not sourced. It's just the latest in this type of genre of books that, you know, doesn't have footnotes, doesn't have academic sourcing, a lot of off-the-record or unnamed sources. Obviously, probably a lot of lower-level campaign staffers who are charmed by the attention of a major journalist and willing to dish the dirt, whether it's true or not. So that's sort of what sparked this this interest. But it goes even further. I mean, if you watch the network news now, regular print journalism, you know, the idea that the stories and the agendas are driven by what someone saw on Twitter, what someone heard from somebody else, this idea that the old-fashioned shoe leather, get the facts, do the research, seems to be disappearing.
Tom, would you respond to that, but also give us a little of your background, because you've seen this change. I mean, you're a young man, but you've had a lot of experience. You've got some gray in that hair.
I started with the Associated Press in 1977 as a college freshman. I lucked into a part-time job, and I have seen it. I think everything you say is absolutely true. I've seen that we have gone from, there's no institutional memory because things are moving too fast. The rules aren't followed. Even a great institution like the Associated Press is now putting out stories that are not ready for circulation. They're not correctly sourced. And not about source, they're not balanced. And then they end up putting out 4 and 5 different versions of the same story, which is great because they want to get it right. But the earlier versions have populated websites all over the country and occasionally find themselves into print the next day because for whatever reason the newspaper didn't use the most recent corrected balanced version. The AP doing that, the rush to get it out is terrible. The Twitter sphere is terrible. The tabloid television shows used to be one or two. I think the first one was A Current Affair in 1987 on Fox. And I'm not knocking Fox. Other non-Fox stations ran it. Then there are, 6 or 7 of them now. It's bad. And everything you say is true. And I've gone back to the days when you couldn't get away with some of the things that are done now.
Well, and I think
I guess my only question is, in terms of this industry that you're talking about, as long as you would tell me that what you're doing is biased right off front, then I'm okay with it. But it's what bothers me is when you say I'm a strict newspaper, but buried within there are all these innuendos and things which are the political side.
Well, there's something else that you bring up. Is a book is written for one reason, almost always for one reason, just to sell copies right, and make money. Yeah. Right. And I don't see books as, even though they're a long-lasting document, I don't see them as the same as the Daily News and the AP and NBC and Fox News as I've been talking about. So there, this issue of poorly sourced and no footnotes, and as you correctly call it, academic sourcing, I think you use that phrase, this started with the book written by Woodward and Bernstein about Richard Nixon called The Final Days. Yeah. They were criticized because the sourcing was questionable. Sure.
But my point about the book is I don't have a problem with the book, and frankly, I'm sure it's very entertaining, which is what it's designed to be, and it's going to sell a lot of copies.
And you'll buy it and read it.
I'll probably buy it and read it. But it's representative of what's going on, to your point, in more of the traditional media and not just traditional newspapers, TV, but on the web and other places. And I think a lot of it also has to do with, which is unfortunate, is the economics of news today.
Bingo.
Khalil, I want to go to you. Because, again, you're written a book called The Arab Lobby, mm-hmm. U.S. Foreign Policy. Mm-hmm. My question to you is, when you look at the way in which media covers a story, how do they cover the Middle East? Are they fair? Are they balanced?
No, they're neither fair nor balanced. And it's the overcoverage on the one hand and the sort of complete dismissal of basic facts on the ground. But look, I mean, we have an entire sphere of unfair, unbiased news. And it's become this echo chamber, really, where people who want conservative news tune into conservative outlets and people who want liberal news tune into liberal outlets, right? And essentially that's
what we have. Or they can turn into Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is trying to be somewhat objective.
Are they succeeding?
I
think so. And actually, with their entry into the American market. So, for example, we have Al Jazeera in Chicago now.
And it's Al Jazeera America.
Al Jazeera America. Right. Right. They are trying to basically bring it back to a news that is objective with the same sort of like infotainment that other news networks have. But I must say that when Al Jazeera, a foreign network, essentially, right, that became only later Americanized, is doing a better job than the, you know, Native American outlets. Right. We really have trouble here.
I think what's interesting about where this conversation is going, in my premise, I never once mentioned the word bias. I mean, I was talking about the quality.
Yeah.
And I think I firmly believe in media bias, and I've always believed that. But that's a little bit of a different topic. And my point on this is I think if you're a sophisticated news consumer – you recognize bias when you see it.
Right. But even
if you're a sophisticated news consumer and the quality of the news you're getting is poor, meaning not correct, you may not know. And then you will, to your point,
Tom,
these things find their way around the internet.
Following up on what we talked about when Mike Miller was talking about academia and most of those in academia being left of center, would you acknowledge that in newsrooms where you have worked, has there been a liberal persuasion in those newsrooms?
I would say no. And I've worked at newsrooms owned and operated by CBS, Fox, NBC, the Associated Press, which is owned by the members, and others I can't even recall, Tribune Broadcasting, WGN in Chicago. And I would say no. Is it 50-50? Not necessarily. I see a lot
more. So you'd see a lot of pro-life. You'd run into a lot of pro-life people in those newsrooms?
Well, if you want to pick an individual.
Let's pick a topic.
On that topic, no. I would say the majority of news personnel in this country are pro-choice.
Do people go into media just like those that go into academia? Do they go into that profession because they want to change the world more than change the world?
I met very few ideologues in journalism over my 30-plus years in it. As a consultant, a lot of time
in sports, though.
Yes, but I also represented a lot of newscasters as a consultant. And they're in it, and in the broadcast end, they're in it because they want to be on TV. They don't really have an ideological approach. And the writers I know, the young writers coming along, they really love the kick out of reporting. I haven't heard any bias or ideological reasons for getting into it.
But I think Bruce got an important, you know, asking about a specific issue, for example. So you remember the book came out maybe 10 years ago, Bias by Bernard Goldberg.
Yes, and it was what I was going to bring up.
So I thought the most persuasive argument in that book was not that the media and the people going into newsrooms and newspapers are inherently biased and are there to be biased, but they all come from the same mindset.
Right.
They don't know anyone unlike themselves.
That's right.
They
right.
don't
exactly
know pro-life right. people. They don't know pro-gun people. They live in an urban environment generally,
which is why we have had for 33 years now, we've had Beyond the Beltway, Because whether you're left of center or right of center, if you are a journalist and you're all swimming in the roles in the pools around Washington, and you're going to the same social parties, and your kids are going to the same schools, you, even if you're a conservative, you will have the same insular feeling, and you really won't know what's really going on beyond the Beltway. And that's why we are who we are. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll go to calls in just a moment. But Tom Scherer, you want to, before we go to your thing, you wanted to make a point about that caller we had about 20 minutes ago who said all conservatives were racists.
Right. I think I've talked more than enough on this show tonight, but I did feel compelled to say in my opinion, and I talk to a lot, I have a lot of Republican friends. I come in contact with a lot of people who do not like Barack Obama. His politics or whatever. And I am quite the opposite, and I defend the president. I think he's been unfairly maligned. I think he's been treated very shabbily by far too many people.
But
that said, I don't think it's racially driven in most cases. I hear a couple things once in a while that I would classify as racially insensitive and biased against him. Yes, I'm not stupid. There is racism in this country. It has existed since we began. It'll exist, unfortunately, for years to come. But I don't think it is the even close to being the majority of the reasons why the president is unfairly criticized.
Now, what is your topic? What's the topic you want to get off your chest?
My topic is, it goes to the criticism of the president, but it's a conceptual thing. And that is the dramatic increase in this country of security measures. Cameras in the streets. Cameras everywhere. The NSA listening to people's phone calls and monitoring the internet activity and everything else. I believe it is necessary and good. I believe it's regrettable, but it ensures our safety and security as a nation. And I resent it when people criticize the president for taking those things to even higher levels. I do not think George W. Bush was a good president. I think he was an abomination as a president. But we owe him this debt. After September 11th, he changed the policy of how we handle things and handle national security. I don't agree with a lot of the secretive things that were done in his presidency unrelated to national security. But the fact of the matter is we haven't had an attack on United States soil. We've come close a couple of times, but we're not letting 21 terrorists reside in this country and train themselves to take down the Twin Towers. If they're here, they're arrested, they're monitored, or they are killed. And no one knows this is happening. The CIA and intelligence people around the world have been killing our enemies since September 11th, 2001. It was started by George W. Bush, necessarily so. It's been continued by Barack Obama. But he gets criticized for the drone attacks and for the NSA and the monitoring of this and the monitoring. How do you think you track terrorism? Go live in Israel. How do you think they ensure their safety and security? So it bothers me that the Republicans, who invented conservative approaches to safety and security, are now, and did a good job with it, are separate from excesses, are now criticizing Obama for doing the same thing.
Well, first of all, not all Republicans are criticizing him for that. There are a lot of Republicans that agree
with
him.
I haven't heard any Democrats criticize Obama for safety and security. Not very many for safety and security, for the NSA and the drone attacks and all this stuff. Spying domestically, arresting American citizens abroad. Who cares if you're a citizen or not? You're a terrorist. You've got to get out.
You know, you're lumping a lot of things together. I think drone attacks, espionage overseas, tracking our enemies, that's one thing. Some of the stuff that's going on domestically through the NSA, this mass – when you hear the number, just the sheer number of emails and phone calls and things that are captured and recorded – and there's no strategy to that. They're just dredging up as much information as they can, and you know, to me, that does not sound strategic.
Khalil,
I find it hard to believe that that's led
Khalil,
to.
How do you react to that? Because again, when you get on a plane, they may look at you differently than they look at me.
Sure. And look, we live in a society that is overly photographed, that is overly on camera. We have a violation, essentially. We have the Fourth Amendment being eviscerated. And I'm glad that especially people in the conservative establishment that are raising this point. I mean, we have to basically step back from the ledge. We live in a society where we have too much monitoring and not enough of the monitoring, right? So, for example, I want to, you know, take issue with something that Tom said earlier, and that is that, you know, we haven't had an attack on this country, right? What do you call the Boston bombings? I mean, are two individuals that basically
international terrorism. There's no connection. We know that. It's been investigated thoroughly. There's no tie to a foreign nation.
Those guys were photographed. They knew about them. The Russian intelligence told us all kinds of things about them.
It was a mistake.
Let's pay attention to the things that matter instead of trying to photograph and monitor every single American out there.
We caught those guys because of cameras.
Khalil spoke it. He said it so well. I mean, the Fourth Amendment really does matter. Why are you listening? Why are they keeping a record of every phone call I make?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, when I call Bahrain and so forth and I send emails over there, I guess I can understand. I'm sending something to the Middle East. Has to do with my research, but I'm doing it. But why, when I call my wife and I text my sons, we kiddingly put in, hello, NSA. Why are they listening to me? They have no right to be doing this.
The reason is very simple. You have to gather the information to be able to find if there's useful information in there. They're not listening to all your calls. They're gathering them, but they're not listening to them.
They have a record. They know who I call, what doctors I call. They know everything. They have no
invading his privacy.
They're damn right.
They
don't
know what they're doing with that information.
I agree.
Why would they keep it once they realize I've not done anything wrong? Why don't they get rid of it?
We don't know that they're not. There's a technology component of this. I agree that it's invasion of privacy, but things have changed. If we had invaded the privacy of those 21 guys who took
safety,
down the airliners,
you're going to have neither.
Yep, exactly. Thank you. John? Ben Franklin said it.
That's exactly right.
Go ahead, say it again.
Ben Franklin, right? I mean, basically, you're trading your freedom for your safety, right? And that's never a trade-off that we should ever make. And I would add also,
I'm not saying it should be unlimited.
On the point of foreign policy, right? We have more terrorists operating in the world right now. Just because we eviscerated them from Afghanistan, they're now operating in Yemen. They're now operating in Libya, right? So we have to have a better way to approach terrorism, not surveying everybody that exists under the sun.
I don't disagree with that. It's almost an impossible tiger to catch by the tail or by the head. And I don't advocate unlimited invasion of anyone's privacy. But at some point, you have to acknowledge that the world is a much different place now. We have to adjust on the fly.
That was Tom Scherer. Thanks to Tom Scherer and Khalil Morar for being with us in our broadcast this evening. And also John McGovern and Mike Miller, thank you very much for being the right side of our table this evening. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Thanks to Tom Vera-Cruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of the program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.